Hello again and welcome to the Stuart Crazy Podcast. It has been a bit of a break, but we are back with more history-related content and hopefully some fun as well.
Yes, welcome to 2022. The world's crazy out there, but we're going to get crazier by having some fun topics about history.
Stuart Crazier, I might add.
Stuart Crazier, yes.
For those of you who don't know, I'm Rob Nelson, the host. I'm joined today by Carly Kramers, the Director of Education here at Stuart Museum.
Hello, hello.
And today we're going to be talking about something that both of us are pretty interested, the Victorian era, but specifically the dangers of the Victorian home and the Victorian kitchen. Nightmares lurking around every corner, I believe.
Unknown nightmares at that. A lot of these were surprises for people that, looking back, it's interesting because it's like, of course, why would you think that consuming X, Y, or Z would make you healthier?
Yeah.
People didn't know better.
Yeah, and it's important to kind of contextualize the time that we're talking about. For those of you who don't know, the reason they call it the Victorian era, let's just maybe start there.
Yeah.
Is because Queen Victoria reigned in England between 1837 and 1901. A very, very long time.
Yeah.
In which a lot of things happened and became defined as being Victorian. And not so much good things.
Yes, definitely. And I'm glad that you contextualized it because often even in my brain, when I think Victorian, I think of a certain kind of house and a parlor and all these fancy things. But it's literally just the name of that period. So it can be any kind of place, whether it's urban, rural, etc. It's more the time period. And a lot of these hazards lurked in all areas.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that the Victorian era is known for is the pursuit of purity. And that, you know, that went to moral purity, that went to religious purity.
When they found out about germs.
Exactly. It also went into cleaning purity and food purity. Mm-hmm. And that's where this rabbit hole is leading us, I think you can tell.
Mm-hmm. You can become too pure with your food by putting acid in it. But we'll get to that.
Exactly. So what about the Victorian era led to the kind of situation we're talking? What was happening that made people able to purchase products that weren't good for them that caused, you know, irreparable harm to their health?
Yeah, so if we think about that time period, a big thing called the Industrial Age happened during that, where people that were born in the 1840s, you know, they went from walking to horsepower to steam powered and beyond, depending on how long they lived for.
Yeah.
And so with this rapid progress, there was a lot of excitement about what could be, but then people didn't always know the consequences if they were to do something that at face value seems like it would be a good idea.
Yeah.
Which even happens today. But we're able to look back in hindsight and say, oh, yeah, of course that wouldn't work. But so, especially like with the Victorian kitchen, trying to make it a more modern place, in some ways it became more dangerous. And with the development of steam-powered and mass transit and more people coming in and more urban environments, you couldn't always have fresh food at places, and so they were starting to bring in foods from farther away, not always with refrigeration, using different ingredients to keep it fresh, trying different things to become healthier, all these different trial and errors that sometimes had deadly consequences.
Yeah, kind of the urban growth of the cities in the late 19th century, it exceeded the ability of society to really catch up with the expectations and the needs
mm-hmm.
of a society.
Yeah.
So when you're talking about sanitation development or something like along those lines, it takes time to install that kind of regulation and safety. And people were just moving way too fast in order for that to really get some legs under it.
Yeah.
It's kind of, I think, probably similar, not to jump off topic, to what's going on today with a lot of like the internet culture.
Yeah.
You know, like some of our internet regulations were established in the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
And really we have just gone leaps and bounds since then. And we're really, you know,
But also maybe people 100 years from now, like there might be consequences to what we're doing right now, especially with the rapid growth of technology and how it's affecting our brains or the blue light. Who knows where...
Yeah.
People 100 years from now might say, how did they not know that that would have those consequences? And
yeah.
It's because this is all so new. And when things are new and you're just trying to keep up with the need and the demand, you can't do trial studies that last 20 years and say, hold on, people.
Exactly.
Don't go so fast. And, you know, with the industrialization and the urbanization, if you have people that are getting crammed and having more in a condensed area, they need food. You can't exactly just say, oh, let us test run some different ways to get you some food to keep it so you stay alive. No, they had to say, oh, well, the nearest farm at this point is now 30, 40 miles away. We have steam power. We can't exactly have cows just hanging out and making dairy inside the city. So let's make it so our milk takes a few days to get here and drink it from there.
Yeah. And I mean, even if you were living in a rural place, the advertisements of the time were making it appear that some of these, you know, preservatives that we're talking about adding to foods mm-hmm. were safe. It flowed with the narrative of the time that, you know, you could put borax in your milk because it was a purifier of your milk.
Yeah.
And so that sounds good. I want to drink pure milk. So let's put mm-hmm. some borax in there. By the way, that's the stuff that we use to kill ants.
Yes.
And we'll do that, and it'll make the milk that tends to go sour too quickly last a little bit longer.
Yeah.
The logic is there.
Or like formaldehyde, which is what we use now to preserve dead bodies. I guess like you could theoretically use it to preserve food, but then it's yeah. not something you want to ingest. There were lots of other wild things that were put inside of food. What else do you have in your notes?
Yeah, so I'm trying to give them the best intentions with situations like that. I don't necessarily see the corrupting hand of, you know, unbridled capitalism working with examples like that.
Mm-hmm.
But things like such as adulterated bread with alum, which is a metal compound in like loaves of bread in order to make it whiter or appear whiter. But then they would also add all sorts of things like something called plaster of Paris, chalk, mm-hmm. bean flour, all of these sorts of preservatives that today are found in detergent, mind you.
Mm-hmm.
They would make it whiter, but also heavier. And again, back to that Victorian sense of purity, the color white has a long history of symbolism with purity.
Mm-hmm.
And while today you might go to Whole Foods or wherever you purchase your bread and say, oh, I want this grainy, brown, beautiful looking loaf of bread, at that time, the pursuit was the exact opposite. And
mm-hmm.
it was white equaled healthy. It equaled pure. It equaled, you know, untouched by human hands sorts mm-hmm. of things. And people took advantage of that.
Definitely. And there were people that made decisions about changing food because they thought it would have good intentions. But then, like you said, there were places that in order to have less money put into the food they were putting out, but then still make the same revenue from people, they would put in things that didn't have exact nutrient value, such as spices would have ground up coconut shells, charred rope, brick dust, floor sweepings, and you would find honey, but a lot of it was just dyed corn syrup. There was coffee that contained stardust, tree bark, charred bone, or fake coffee beans made out of wax and dirt, which I don't really understand how people got away with that one, because I think that like grinding up a bean is different than having just like pre-ground sawdust. I don't know, but
yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
my favorite is definitely pickles that were made to appear green by adding copper compounds.
I love copper.
Something about pickling, which is already kind of a, you know, adding longevity to it.
Yeah, do you need something else? Why do you need copper? Or going back to the milk, this was really gross. So if you're eating, just beware. They would put pureed calf brains into milk to make it look like a richer cream. And then they would also thin milk with water and gelatin and then add dyes or chalk or plaster to correct the color. And then that was also where formaldehyde was used as a preservative. And this all just sounds like the absolute worst milkshake I've ever heard of in my life.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a horror show.
Hundreds of children died. Got sick, not surprisingly.
Potentially way, way more than that, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a test conducted in 1882, and 20,000 milk samples were tested for what was inside of them, and it showed that fully a fifth of them had been adulterated by some form of preservative, such as boractic acid, that was believed to purify the milk. And it's estimated that up to 500,000 children died from what resulted, which was the flourishing of bovine TB, tuberculosis, in milk during the Victorian period. So because of those sorts of processes, it allowed certain bacteria to flourish in milk longer than they otherwise would have if you would have drank the milk on time.
Yeah.
And as a result, 500,000 kids in the Victorian period died drinking their, you know, daily milk.
Yeah. And during the Victorian era was when people started commercialization of toys and spoiling kids and Christmas, giving a lot of gifts. That's when that came into larger popularity, because if your kid was surviving, you were very happy that they were sticking around and you wanted to spoil them so that they were having as good a time as possible, because you didn't know when you would lose little Sally or Johnny, which is a really sad way to think. But then, you know, I can't even imagine being in that era and being a parent with the knowledge of, huh, kids casually die. My kid could die at any point, and I don't know why. They just get sick. And looking back, we're like, this all could have been avoided if people knew better, or if people had better intentions, depending on where the source of food came from and the morals. Yeah.
And it's easy to look past that, because it's such a foreign time to us. You know, people had more children, but more children died. But I just feel like sometimes when I'm reading history or I hear people talking about that era, and they say, oh, and they had like four or five kids died, but that was normal. And they kind of like,
moving on,
brush past that a little bit. There's just no way that as a human being that you were able to just sustain that in a way that was normalized. I just can't see that being the case. And I mean, it might just be that you were unable to really, approach that in history, because we're so far removed from it.
And it's not fun to think about either. It's easier to just say, oh, that was a normal thing. Like, instead of trying to empathize with that situation, because it inevitably makes you sad.
Yeah. I mean, take like, I'm going to talk about Abraham Lincoln, because it's just who I am.
Yep.
His family, I think they had four children, and I think three of them died. Only Robert, the oldest son, survived to adulthood. But Tad, William, and another child whose name I'm forgetting all died before the age of 18 of just various children's, you know, not children's diseases necessarily, but they were more susceptible as children.
Yeah.
And it devastated them, both of them, famously.
Yeah, it's just the humanization of history that makes it feel closer, but then also it's not always the funnest thing to think about. But at least we can be thankful, because some steps were taken.
Yes.
Such as our hero of the day, Dr. Harvey Washington Wiley. He was a chief chemist of the U.S. Agriculture Department during the late 1800s, early 1900s. And he was noticing that there were consequences from food that shouldn't exactly be happening from food, such as people getting sick or dying. And not many people saw the correlation, because that would be a hard correlation to make, because everyone eats food. So if you were to say, ah, these people are getting sick because they're eating foods that are common, I feel like it'd be hard. But he luckily looked into it, and he had something that is so fun called the Poison Squad. The Poison Squad was a group of young men that he employed and made them sign waivers, and then he fed them daily, all three of their meals, and half of them he gave foods that he knew had additives in them, and the other half he gave them food that did not have additives. And with this experiment, he was like, oh, I'll start with food that has borax in it, because like that can't be that bad. That'll probably be like a pretty smooth start in. But no, they got sick pretty quick, and he was alarmed by that. And so he pushed for this a lot, and he wanted to see that legislative change made. And he kind of became more of a public crusader in that way, with his relentless effort for that legislative change. And luckily, President Theodore Roosevelt also saw this as a need and signed the 1906 Pure Food and Drug Act, which was the first regulatory law to enforce safety standards in America, along with the Federal Meat Inspection Act. And he got a lot of pushback from this. He got a lot of smear campaigns had on him. There was a National Association of Food Manufacturers that formed, and companies pooled their resources to oppose the government and also called Dr. Wiley the man who is doing all he can to destroy American business.
Yeah.
Which is wild.
The more things change.
Right?
It sounds so familiar to
I know! To that's what I also thought.
There's always the pushback. Just to kind of parallel on that, I did a fair amount of research on this topic myself. A lot of these people got really sick and removed themselves from the trial because they were, you know, you can't just sit around casually eating borax.
Yeah, but people were, which is wild.
But of the original 12-person trial that he had, only three made it to the end of the trial. The rest removed themselves from the test because they were so physically ill that they could not withstand what was happening, so they had to withdraw. This test, these results were reported in newspapers, and this grew the public unease about some of these products that were circulating out there. And also during this time, he wasn't alone in this effort. Mm-hmm. This was known by, or at least casually known by some people, that something was not right here.
Mm-hmm.
Around the same time, you have the publication of The Jungle by Upton Sinclair, which talks about the meatpacking industry and the just Wild West story of industry happening there at that period. And so like these things start to get addressed. And so somebody like Upton Sinclair, you know, he had a famous quote that everyone always says, and he said, his book was aimed at the public's heart, and by accident I hit him in the stomach. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of that kind of saying, but even despite this, the 1906 passage of the Pure Food and Drugs Act, that isn't the end of the story, because it takes until 1930, a full quarter of a century later, to create the FDA.
Mm-hmm.
And then the FDA doesn't even really gain full power until 1938. And in that year, Congress passes a law that gave that department enforcement of their agency and what they sought to do. So even still removed, that's the length of my lifetime between 1906 to 1938. That's the length of time I have been alive as a 32-year-old man.
Yeah.
Before
that people continued having businesses being allowed in the world to put things that weren't great.
Yeah.
And I mean, there were lawsuits that the government and Dr. Wiley would take different businesses to. So he had a case against flour manufacturers to prohibit them from literally bleaching their product and adding nitrates to the mix. But the Supreme Court struck that down and said that didn't fly. But then there were other cases like with Coca-Cola, where it might be a common fact at this point that Coca-Cola originally was made with cocaine, hence Coca-Cola. So the state of Georgia said, hey, Coca-Cola, please remove cocaine from your beverage. And that was in 1902. So then Coca-Cola replaced it with massive amounts of caffeine, which I guess is better than cocaine, but too much. You should limit that also. So Dr. Wiley and the government took Coca-Cola to court, and the Supreme Court sided with Wiley and the government this time. So Coca-Cola had to cut their caffeine in half. So sorry for anyone that wishes that their pop had more caffeine than it does. I guess you can blame Dr. Wiley.
No, and as you say, those are very public trials. You're going after places like companies like Coca-Cola.
Mm-hmm.
There was even a song that was created by the publicity surrounding the Poison Squad. And the first verse of the song was, "For we are the Poison Squad. On prussic acid we break our fast. We lunch on a morphine stew. We dine with a matchhead consomme. Drink carbolic acid brew." Delicious. Very, very catchy, clearly.
Yeah, it was.
Don't know why I didn't catch on.
Yeah, it'll always stick in my head with those large words that semi-rhymed. But yeah. I'm glad that things aren't like this now, but, you know, who knows? Maybe people will look back and say, yellow dye number 5. How did people not understand the consequences of yellow dye number 5?
Or I mean, and we've seen this still kind of play out in other ways, like the fight over trans fats.
Mm-hmm.
And even, you know, companies in the modern age having to put calories on the board at fast food restaurants.
Yeah.
Or release, you know, just the nutrient info. I mean, do either of us know what's in a Monster energy drink? I don't.
I don't. Or like Super Size Me, the movie that
yeah, exactly.
had the whole country watching it. And, you know, you'll every once in a while see viral videos of like, this is what's in your chicken nugget. And then people have outrage and some people are out there trying to make changes. Like Dr. Wiley was out there trying to make changes, but then sometimes being modern folks and with everything that's thrown at us, it's hard to understand exactly what is actually dangerous or what is one company telling us is dangerous versus others. So at least we can hopefully rely on these larger acts and like the FDA to make sure that we don't repeat history and have hundreds and thousands of children dying from just milk.
Yeah, we can only hope. Yeah. The fight goes on. Like, and as we're saying, you know, the more you learn, the more progress that you can make in areas like this.
Mm-hmm.
This is at the beginning of where this whole fight begins, is really not much long after that germ theory is largely coming into popularity and in vogue and mm-hmm. being furthered in academia and stuff like that. And it takes a while for those things to percolate and get into the modern culture.
Mm-hmm.
But that, you know, every day we learn new things.
Yeah.
And, you know, society in 100 years will look back on this time and say, you know, we were talking about social media earlier. I can't believe they let their kids be on Facebook at 8 years old, you know, or yeah. something like that. In the same way that we're talking about putting arsenic on candy to get it a green dye or maybe something like that.
I wonder if you had any grandparents back then being like, when I grew up, I had all the arsenic on my candy and I turned out fine.
Yeah, I mean, my grandparents cooked with lard on the flat iron. So, you live and you learn, and sometimes you live and other times you don't. But
exactly. Yes, and we can learn from the struggles that people had. And yeah.
Well, Carly, thank you so much for being on this new season, a new episode of the podcast.
Off to a crazy start. I love it.
Off to a stir crazy start. And why don't we pause right now, and when we come back, I'll be talking with Kay Sanova, who is the Director of Interpretation here at Stir Museum, about this same topic, but on a much more localized front, and how it affected the people of Hall County, Nebraska, during this area that we're talking about. So stick with us, and we'll be back after these words. Thanks.
Hey, all you Stir crazy listeners. Did you know Stir Museum has a bistro? That's right. You heard correct. Now available in the Leo B. Stir Building, Stir Museum visitors will have the chance to partake in an assortment of delicious options for meals during the day of their visit. With selections like artisan sandwiches, paninis, wraps, and a rotating soup and salad menu, it's a must after a long, hard morning. Oh, you say you're more of a fan of pastries and desserts? Well, the bistro has more than enough items to satisfy your sweet tooth. In fact, whatever your reason is for visiting Stir Museum, the Stir Bistro is a must. You'd be crazy not to.
And we're back with more of the Stir Crazy podcast. In the second half of the show, we're going to be talking with the Director of Interpretation, Kay Sanova, about the same topic, but on a much more localized scale. The Victorian home, the dangers within the home, specifically in the kitchen, etc.
And specifically in the Hall County area.
Specifically in the Hall County, Nebraska area, exactly. So why don't we dive right in, and I'll just ask you this. How dangerous was the 1890s home or the 1890s kitchen in Hall County? And did the people have a perception that it was dangerous, or is that our look back as a, you know, kind of funny anecdote of how dangerous it was?
Well, that's our hindsight is 2020 thing. You know,
exactly.
We can look back from our perspective here and recognize that there was a lot of dangers in the home, that they, a lot of the things that they never realized, but there were some things that, you know, new inventions that were supposed to be all of these helpful, time-saving things that they're supposed to make life easier, in fact, ended up being hazardous.
Yeah. What were some of those things?
Well, the biggest one I can think of is the gasoline stove.
Okay, yeah.
That's the biggest one I can think of. The unknown or unseen hazards had to do with poisons that ended up being in a whole bunch of stuff that they used on a daily basis.
Yeah, and I'm kind of drawn to fires specifically, that like when we're talking about gas in the home is really a bigger contributing factor.
It because there was you had different type, because most of the stoves, especially in our area, were probably coal stoves, because we have all these coal vendors that are getting coal shipped in, because we didn't have a lot of trees in this area. Any sure. trees that we had would have grown along the river, and when the railroads came through and needed to make ties, they harvested, you know, basically denuded most of everything in order to help make those ties. So there wasn't a lot of timber around. So coal was being shipped in once communities became more established, and so there were coal stoves. Well, when they actually came out with the kerosene or coal oil or gasoline stoves in the 1890s, it could be a little bit earlier, but I think 1890s is going to be, I looked 1890s to 1930 yeah. on that, and it was a little, it could set like on a tabletop, and there was one or two burners. You could use it for laundry or for cooking, and it had attached to it somehow a little reservoir. Oftentimes they were standing up on a single rigid tiny pipe, and it was a gravity feed of the fuel to the stove.
Yeah, that seems a little bit difficult to handle or manage.
I'm thinking that I wonder how many of those little skinny tubes broke in half.
Yeah.
And once you bend metal like that, it just never, you get cracks and breaks and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, and just the homes themselves. I mean, we're talking about kind of, well, are we talking about in Hall County, Nebraska, like mm-hmm. a thatched roof, wooden structure with, you know, several buildings next to each other that are also of the same materials?
Yeah, you've got the wood shake roofs and you've got the wood structures and all that. So you've got all these wood frame homes, and especially, you know, early on, they harvested what they could, they built with what they had. And then later on, as the railroads came in, they were able to replace more things. But you have all these wood frame structures, and fires happened.
Yeah. Were there any precautions that people took?
I think at
during
first,
this time?
I think at first they didn't know some of this stuff. Certainly they were very aware of fires, because prairie fires were so prevalent at the time. They you know, would periodically roll through an area. But it happened. It's just like a lightning strike or somebody yeah. throwing a match out on the ground. Those kind of things still happen to this day. But the precautions is the establishment of the volunteer fire services. And some areas actually got water established earlier on than others. There were some areas that didn't get water established. There was one instance that I found in the newspaper that the fire at the home, they didn't have water to the area, and they had to put the poor girl who had caught on fire, they had to dump a tub of water on her to kind of put the fire out.
Yeah, and I mean, this isn't local, but I've read stories of more in the colonial era, even so going further back than really Hall County in terms of the modern Hall
yeah,
County.
There's a lot of interesting theories about women and hearth cooking in colonial and some of the early pre-stove period of time, where death by petticoat mm-hmm. is a very well-known within the living history world book that was written by Mary Miley Theobald, who worked for 13 years with Colonial Williamsburg, is a college professor teaching history and museum studies at the University of Richmond. She has a blog called History Myths Debunked, and Revisited Myth Number 2 is Burning to Death from Long Petticoats Catching Fire was the leading cause of death for colonial women after childbirth.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you about. I know that this is a myth I've heard often repeated here working at Stir Museum, and you know, our interpreters are in railroad town, they're wearing these long dresses. And
mm-hmm. But the thing about it is, we're not working around hearths.
Yeah.
We're not working with hearths, and a hearth is a different thing. But it was not the leading cause of death for colonial women. It was actually around the issue of childbirth.
Sure.
Is what that was. The kind of clothing that was worn, and one of the reasons that we reinforce so strongly that our interpreters wear natural fiber clothing, it would kind of help prevent. There's one instance I found that a girl, some of the burns were not as severe because of the type of underwear she was wearing.
Yeah.
But
there's nothing synthetic in it.
No, there's no synthetic. Exactly. You don't have a synthetic start showing up until about the 1920s. But Dr. Theobald, in her blog, debunks this myth and talks about, you know, how, the origins and all this other stuff. The blog post that she puts out about there's so many myths with history that have just been perpetuated over time. Her book, Death by Petticoat, is a really interesting read. And in some cases, I can't remember, she actually traced back how this got started. Mm-hmm. But it could have just been an innocent story told by somebody. That's why it's so important that we get things right. But it's her blog is History Myths Debunked, if people want to go and put in their favorite myth and or favorite story that they've heard and maybe find out if it's true or not.
Well, I'm wondering if it has anything to do with the development of celluloid in clothing, because that actually is a pretty flammable material that starts getting introduced in collars and like cuffs like that people would wear. That's around our period, 1890s.
It's going to be the late 90s when they start having the high stiff collars and all of that. And they actually made, it was a plastic like material that they would make to some of the ladies' collars. They would stiffen up from like the base of the neck almost to the back of the ears.
Yeah.
With some of those, but some of them were wires. I don't know if there's a connection with that. Sometimes they translate, oh, this happened only in colonial times, and they'll try to craft this to, oh, it happened to women all the time. Sure. It was the number one. Women caught fire all the time. Did some catch fire? Yes. Indeed, they do. I have documented accounts of that. Did it happen all the time? Was it the leading cause of death? No. It was surrounding childbirth.
Yeah.
Was the leading cause of death in women. And in some countries, it still is.
Yeah, of course. I just bring up celluloid because it becomes widely available in several places in the home around the time that we here at Stur Museum and in Hall County mm-hmm. interpret. You know, it starts out as being a replacement for the very expensive, very ornate material of ivory. Celluloid materials start getting made into combs.
I think there's more, some of this, what they, I guess you would call it a synthetic silk. Because silk was very expensive. Silk had its own problems because sometimes silks were weighted with lead. And that's why if you ever see a fabric that's silk-like, that looks like a cat shredded it, it's a weighted silk.
Yeah.
It shatters. It just falls apart. But I don't know if there's a connection to that type of thing. Modern synthetics have their own problems. Because if you were to have a modern synthetic, even if it's a partial synthetic in a fabric, if you got really close to a stove, chances are it may not necessarily catch on fire, but it could melt, and that would melt into your skin.
Oh, boy.
And that's probably a burn you really don't want to have.
No, that's irreversible.
Yeah, that would not be fun.
Well, while these, you know, period clothing items may not have been as dangerous as sometimes people make them out to be. There were things that went into clothing. Sometimes I'm talking about dyes
mm-hmm.
That did end up becoming very dangerous to people.
Yeah.
Isn't that correct? Yes. With, you know, arsenic coloring and things of that.
Probably the most well known is arsenic green.
Yes.
And that particular color was a brief period of time right around the 1860s, but you there's all kinds of poisons or materials that they didn't didn't know there was a problem with it, or they knew and they chose to ignore it. And those types of things were in clothing, food, cooking utensils, water pipes, carpets, wallpaper, colored paper used for kids to play with, and toys, just to name a few.
Yeah, I found one article from an 1875 paper in Grand Island that talked about the wallpaper in a bedroom giving off arsenic vapors that were making the family sick. That was a unique circumstance. And also silk socks and stockings that were in very brilliant colors that were having sort of the same effect.
Yeah, some of the dyes, some of the colors, the different things. They talked about, in 1877, there was an article that was appeared in the Grand Island paper. It was probably a serial thing that appeared in papers across the country. There was a talk by an address by George T. Engel, and he was speaking before the American Social Science Association in Saratoga, New York, on the 10th of September, 1879. And he talked about the peril from poison and adulterated foods. But he goes on for four columns long in the newspaper about the perils in food, drink, carpeting, wallpaper, all of this stuff. Some of the things that I made note of is they would put red ochre or cinnabar or sulfate of mercury in cayenne pepper to stretch it out. Over only 30% of cream of tartar was actually cream of tartar. 30%. The rest of it was something called white earth, which evidently was very bad for you. So there are those types of instances. They would use all of these different chemicals and everything that were harmful in the process of making all these things that came into the family home. And not only did it affect those people in their homes, all of these homes, but it affected the workers who were making these products.
Yeah, absolutely. The famous case of the Mad Hatter syndrome, I think you're well aware of.
Yes.
Treating hats with mercury leads you to become mad over time.
Yeah, it's an over time thing. And there was just a little bit of mythology going on with that too. So I really...
Sure. I mean, I feel like the people who are making this, a lot of these things, and using arsenic, you know, like if you're putting it in makeup or you're putting it in a hat or another piece of clothing, are they doing it because there's no other way to get arsenic green?
Well, the other thing, I think it was arsenic, was used in some, and there weren't a lot of women who were using makeups and that type of thing. But some of the stuff, I think it was arsenic, that actually in small doses gives you a very pale complexion.
Ah.
And so that was a desired look. But over time, that kind of stuff kind of builds up in your system.
I actually found another article from Grand Island from 1886, and you just perfectly set me up for that one. I don't know if you tried to or not.
No, I did. No effort whatsoever.
But the title of the article is Women Who Eat Arsenic. And it speaks of there's two gentlemen having a conversation about the one gentleman who's a doctor treating a woman for using arsenic in makeup. And the first gentleman says, well, if arsenic produces all these pleasant results like a pale complexion, why shouldn't she use arsenic? And the doctor says, because the good results are only temporary, he says. And she will soon become a physical wreck. Before she gets back to town from the road next spring, she will commence to notice while combing her hair that it will be dropping out freely every day. I have written to her warning her that this and other symptoms will soon develop, but she doesn't believe me now. But as soon as the hair falling commences, she will know that I am speaking the truth. She will stop her arsenic doses in a panic, and in 2 weeks she will be the worst looking object that ever wore female clothing.
Oh, jeez. That was cruel.
Yeah, but, so, I mean, going back to 1886, they were, you know,
women have, some women more than others, have done a lot of interesting things in the name of beauty.
Yeah. This is a very long article. I was, summing it up, but some of the other symptoms of using this arsenic on makeup, especially around the eyes. He said her cheeks will sink in, her fingernails will commence to crack and split apart, and before a week her complexion will be gone. Yeah, all good things that come from using arsenic.
Oh, makes me concerned now because I have fingernails that crack. Hmm.
Well, I don't know.
Might have to test.
What were some of those other, we've kind of talked today about milk. We've talked about bread. You mentioned a few yourself.
We have one. There was one case in 1893 that was rather sensational at the time. It was December of 1893 when Adelia Egge decided that it would be best if the entire family died. And so she baked them some strychnine pancakes for breakfast in the morning. And she was sitting down and eating away. She'd been having some mental issues. And the one sister came down and took a bite and said, "What's wrong with these pancakes?" And Adelia ran off and eventually came back, and she cornered her again and said, "What's wrong?" And she said something like, it'd be best if the entire family died rather than going mad. And so the doctor was called. Everybody else was okay. Nobody actually consumed, except for the one sister had a bite or two. But Adelia unfortunately suicided because of this.
Yeah. That reminds me of another interesting case that was taking place in Hastings, Nebraska. So I guess during this period, before they were able to really test for it, people were just using arsenic like crazy. Mm-hmm. It was the perfect,
You could go down to the druggist and get it, or you could buy some rough on rats.
Yeah.
And which is a rat poison that was readily available, and you could use that.
Yeah, and it was kind of just a little bit of everywhere, including on candy, to give chocolate a certain color of glaze.
Yeah, makes me want to think twice about chocolate.
Yeah, and
briefly, though.
In 1899, in Hastings, there was a charge of attempting to commit murder by a woman there who had purposely, it seems, poisoned people in her own family by using arsenic on candy. And because apparently I've just been doing a little bit of reading on this. This was kind of the silent killer, the how to get away with murder device, if you will,
at the time. Because they didn't have a way to test for it at that time.
Exactly. I mean, and there were so many foodborne deaths that were taking place, food poisoning and the like, that you could almost write it off as that without too much suspicion. But yeah, because it was hiding in plain sight, because they already put arsenic on candy and
all you had to do is up the dosage kind of to get away with that.
Yeah, but I was it's in makeup, it's in candy, it's in clothing, and it's arsenic.
Yeah.
Which is kind of astounding, but
I don't know exactly what the chemical was in flypaper poison of the time, but it was like little thin sheets, and you would put it in a little dish of water, and the flies would come drink the water, and it would kill the flies.
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, a little Grace Meliason, she was about 18 months old. There was a dish of flypaper poison on a window ledge, and she drank some of it, and she got sick and died. And that's a tragic occurrence that connects to one of our houses here in Railroad Town.
Yeah.
A little girl, and got into something that was just, probably they didn't think about that she would bother it.
No,
but,
and
how kids are. Kids get into everything.
Yeah, and that kind of reminds me of something else that I meant to talk about a little while ago, but the issue of refrigeration in general.
Mm-hmm.
At a time before you had a refrigerator in the home, you used things like burying things underground to keep them cool, or you know, putting them on a ledge, if like next to a window, if it was cold outside, in order to keep things at the temperature that you desired them.
Or on the back porch or something like that. Yeah.
But even the early attempts to create refrigerators led to problems themselves, because the first refrigerators that were created in the early 20th century used ammonia.
Refrigeration was so dicey. You know, usually if you had food, you knew that you had to use it up within a certain period of time, otherwise it might turn. Refrigeration was challenging for food because the food could naturally spoil if you did not keep it at specific. Now we know that there's specific temperatures that we have to keep foods at.
Yeah.
They did not know that then. And so chances are, if they didn't cool it down enough before they put it in an icebox, or if it was left out too long, chances are it could go bad.
Yeah.
And then people would get sick from it.
Yeah, and that's what the early refrigerators were seeking to avoid. Unfortunately, some of the earliest ones, talking about late 19th century, early 20th century, they leaked ammonia and also methyl chloride and sulfur dioxide, which
sound like wonderful ingredients for food.
Yeah, unbeknownst to the people, it damaged the respiratory system and it led to death mm-hmm. in many cases. And it wasn't until Freon was invented in 1928 by this like miracle concoction that ultimately led to also being harmful to yep. the environment in other ways. But that it allowed people to bring the refrigerator into the home at least and be safe for them on a day-to-day mm-hmm. basis, because the early refrigerators, people were even putting them outside because of this, you know, these leaks of ammonia and the like. And so it wasn't even a convenient device until Freon was invented.
Yeah, and there's a lot of gases and things like that have no odor and
exactly
really, although ammonia I would think would have a very strong
yeah.
odor, would be quite harmful.
Yeah.
I kind of want to talk about these, get back to the kerosene stove, the gasoline stoves.
Yeah, let's do it.
We had some instances. I did a search looking at from 1890 through 1930 and came across 51 instances where it's mentioned in the Grand Island paper, and that's just using the search term stove explosion.
Wow.
One of the instances occurred in 1898 in October. It was a gas stove explosion occurred at the residence of Mayor Thompson yesterday afternoon, in which the fine new stove was literally blown to pieces, parts of it being hurled through the window and into the yard. The girl being away, Mrs. Thompson, was herself superintending affairs in the kitchen. She had turned the gas on in the oven and thought she had lighted it, but for some reason it had failed to light. Finally, smelling escaping gas, she struck a match to locate it.
Oh, boy.
Which act was followed by a terrific explosion, which literally tore the stove to pieces. But fortunately, there was no serious bodily injury. Mrs. T escaped with slightly singed eyebrows and hair and severe fright.
Yeah.
Such accidents are indeed rare and can result only from lack of proper care, and was indeed fortunate that no one was seriously hurt. The other instance that I, one of the ones that I'd just like to kind of wrap up with, is a gasoline stove, which is different from a gas, was a kind of like natural gas that we think of now. It was probably more of a carbide gas at that time period. This was a fire in West Lawn. The gasoline stove explosion causes harm. Miss Heyman is burned. About 12:30 this afternoon, the gasoline stove in the residence of Mr. Heyman in West Lawn exploded, and for a time, a serious conflagration was threatened. It was only avoided by the vigorous work of Ora and Alcinous Heyman, the two sons who happened to be home at the time. Miss Sarah Heyman was just alongside the stove when the explosion occurred, and her clothing at once was in flames. The young lady is said to be quite badly burned. Dr. Roeder had been summoned, and at this writing is attending the injured young lady, and it is impossible to state how extensive the injuries are. there being no water service in West Lawn, yet another danger.
There you go.
No alarm was turned in. The neighborhood was at once notified, and everyone in the vicinity hurried to the scene. But before many of them arrived, the fire had been put out by the boys, who formed a lively bucket brigade for a few minutes and had the fire out in a very short time. It is stated that the damages to the building will be about $200.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was talking about. Like, you would have like these local brigades where everybody might have like the bucket on the wall, and there like a, if there was a fire, you'd be near enough, and it would be kind of a civic duty that everyone would get the bucket and go out and help and lend a hand in whatever way they could to help put out the fire. But it just kind of shows that community spirit of we're all in this together a little bit when an instance like a fire breaks out amongst
and that certainly was the case here. Fortunately, it was later reported that Miss Heyman was not as nearly extensively burned as thought originally, because while her outer clothing caught fire, she was wearing wool undergarments, and that helped to protect and save her.
There you go. Nothing synthetic there.
Yeah.
And wool doesn't
burn that. No, it just kind of hangs there. I think, you know, you have to really work hard to burn wool.
Gotcha.
I don't know. I haven't actually actively tried to burn any wool myself.
Yeah. Well, I think we can call it good there.
Safely put this one to bed. And
we have put the fire out, I think.
No matter what, you need to be careful. And just to also mention, because of all of the toxins that are in artifacts of the past, that is one of the reasons why curators at museums have to be very careful.
Exactly.
And one of the reasons that when we handle some objects, we're wearing gloves, because we don't know for sure what's in everything.
Yeah. And, you know, you live and you learn, and we do the best we can. And hopefully there's good actors out there that outweigh the bad actors that have everyone's best interest in mind.
That's all we can hope for.
Casanova, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of the podcast.
Thanks always, for having me.
Always a pleasure when you stop by.
Thank you.
This is going to conclude another episode of the Stuart Crazy Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today. We will be back next month, in the month of February, with a new episode in this long season of the Stuart Crazy Podcast. Thanks so much.